is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime. 9 o'clock horses. Episode 15. When Robin sauntered into the kitchen, her eyes widened, seeing Canyon sitting at the table with me. "I thought I heard voices," she said. "Canyon, when did you arrive?" Canyon rose from the table and gave Robin a long hug. "Robin, Robin," he said, standing back to look at her, "still as beautiful as ever." Robin blushed and turned away, but I could sense that she was obviously flattered by his words. I noticed when he hugged her, she pushed herself against him. I wondered how fond he was of her. It seemed obvious she really liked him. Canyon handed Robin in the telegram. "This man certainly seemed to take charge of things," I thought. When she read it, she looked at me and shook her head. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm sure he'll be all right, though. You mustn't worry about things until you know more." That was the way it was left. All I could do was to try and forget it for now. Robin wasn't about to let me off the hook for the day's work she had on the schedule for me. Today I was to clean the silver and make sure the butler's pantry was clean. She said she'd found stains in the sink there. I consoled myself with the thought that at least Canyon was sympathetic to my problem when he came over to me and took my hand in a gentle grip just for a moment. Robin gave me a look that was estimation, a warning. She need not have worried. Handsome though this man was, I had no intention of making a play for him now or in the future. But he was an ally, and that was important to me. Days slipped by one into the other. I had to force myself to stop dwelling on Colin and his fate, whatever it might be. Although I obviously worried internally because I lost my appetite completely. Robin was a splendid cook. Everyone at her parties raved about her Italian dishes that I had never experienced in England. I realized how narrow my existence had been in UK. One of my duties was to take care of laundry, and I finally managed to get the hang of the washing machine and the dryer. Aunt Olive had a very small washing machine, but no dryer. All the washing was hung on the line to dry. My mother's system was archaic. She had to boil water in a large brick copper with a coal fire underneath to heat the water. The water was then transferred to a metal tub, and the laundry was punched with a metal cone with holes in it on a stick. The clothes were rinsed by hand in the sink, then shoved through two rollers of the mangle. Everything was hung outside on the line to dry. Monday was wash day in our house, and it did take all day. Now, at the Devereaux's, I could pop the laundry into the washing machine and have it dried and ready to iron within a couple of hours. I wasn't asked to clean windows, but I did iron for the boys' shirts and pants. Mr. D's were sent to the cleaners. Meanwhile, I was aware that when Canyon was around the house, Robin seemed happier. Even her demeanour was softer toward me when he sat in the kitchen talking to her. Perhaps she realized I was not a threat to her and her association with Canyon, if there was one. I found Clifford to be a quiet man. He seemed content to tuck himself away in his office in the mornings, oblivious to the comings and goings of the family. He spent most afternoons watching television in the day room. I always knew where he was because of the ubiquitous and nauseating smell from half-smoked cigars left in the ashtrays. Jeremiah and I had decided that after divorcing Canyon's mother, Clifford obviously married Robin because of her looks. And thinking we knew Robin well, with her taste for expensive clothes and furniture, we were certain she must have married him for his money. I didn't notice a display of affection between the two. But I imagine Mr. D, at 80, was content to have the house running smoothly under her supervision. Although I wondered, after seeing Canyon and Robin together, if she had more than a stepmother's affection for him. Or was she just a flirt? I rather suspected the latter. It wasn't until 2 months later, on a beautiful August morning, I learned that Robin had another admirer. Hugo, the Italian who delivered the groceries, became a contender for her attention. I could tell by the way she greeted him and the way she dressed on Tuesdays. When he came to the back door, laden with bags of food and wonderfully fresh baked bread, she was very, very congenial. I didn't realize that this man's appearance at Fairview House would portend a turn of events for me over which I'd had no control. Around 11:30, the doorbell rang at the kitchen entrance. Unlike the melodious front door chimes, the back door had a buzzer. The button had a tendency to stick down, and unless the caller lifted his finger from it, it didn't stop buzzing until the button finally popped out, sometimes minutes later. I was in the hall when I heard the brief buzz, and Robin opened the door promptly. Hugo's accent was unmistakable. I went on upstairs to perform my daily duty of bed-making and thought no more about Robin and Hugo. At noon, I went downstairs and into the kitchen for lunch. I opened the door to the butler's pantry where cutlery and everyday dinnerware was kept. There, leaning against the counter, was Robin with her arms around Hugo's neck. Her skirt was up around her waist, and I could only guess where his hands were. I didn't wait to find out. In horror, I closed the door and fled upstairs to my apartment. What was to happen now? Either she would ignore the event, which I hoped, or, oh God, she may want me gone. The thought entered my mind just momentarily that she could be a candidate for blackmail. How delicious to have the opportunity to blacken her name. But it was clear to me the obvious solution would be for Robin to invent an excuse to be rid of me before I could spread the word, to her husband anyway, about her philandering. I could cause a scandal, if not ruin her life, I thought. But logically, she would fire me. She would have to. Half an hour later, she knocked on my door and walked in. After sitting down on the sofa and crossing her legs casually, as she had done the first time, she leaned back with one arm draped across the back of the sofa, looked directly into my eyes. "You know I'm going to have to dismiss you," she said. There was even a hint of laughter in her voice. "Why?" I asked. I was trying to keep my voice even, innocent. "You know perfectly well, dear." "Why?" "Oh, it's none of my business. What goes on in this house," I said, trying to sound sincere. "Really?" I was back on stage. I put on my best British accent. "It's none of my business." I could feel the intensity of her gaze. Her voice turned gravelly. "Do you think I was born yesterday?" "But it is none of my business," I said. I don't even know anyone except Jeremy, and he wouldn't care what you do. It's not his business either. We both appreciate being here, you know that." For a moment, it looked as if she was reconsidering. Then she confirmed my fears. "Look, dear, it really is not going to work." It sounded to me as though she thought she was talking to an idiot. A conciliatory tone in her voice. "I know Clifford likes you a lot, and apparently so does Canyon, so I'll write a good reference for you." She uncrossed her legs and sighed. "I think it's best for all of us if I buy your ticket home to England. I think you fit better there anyway, don't you?" "Oh, no," I said, I have nothing to go home to. What about my fiancé serving in your war? When he comes out of the army, I want to be here for him." "I'm sorry," she said, rising from the couch. "That could be years. If he is a POW, he most likely will not be released until the war ends, and that may not happen for a long, long time. I suggest you go home and pick up your life where you left off. Now, wouldn't that be best?" Her voice was lower now. "There is nothing you can do here anyway if your boyfriend is being held hostage in some godforsaken country. You know that, don't you?" Her voice had softened and she smiled as she walked to the door. Now, I'm going to call BOAC, and if there's a flight to UK in a few days, I think you should be on it. In the meantime, I would appreciate your cooperation in not spreading any rumors about me. I could let you go right this minute, but I trust you, and I'm going to write you a check for $500 that will serve as severance pay, with the understanding that you tell everyone your mother is ill and you have to return to England right away. I'll make sure your travel is in first class. How would that be? If any of the story gets back to Clifford, I will not give you the money and I shall cancel your flight home. You'll be here, but out on your own. I lay down on the bed and bawled. Barely 6 months in America, and already I was to go back home, and it wasn't my fault. I didn't want to go back to England and admit defeat, but I had to escape somewhere. I was homeless yet again, and again I thought it might be possible for me to go to Africa. Why not? I had received a letter from my sister only a few weeks ago, but things had turned nasty in Ghana. Apparently there was a coup d'etat. Families, especially those from other countries, were in great danger. Expatriates could be banned from the country without any of their assets. At least Richard, my sister's husband, was smart. He had arranged for his income from Singer to be put into a Swiss bank. The Togolese coup d'etat in 1963 was a wake-up call for both Pauline and Richard. Even though the government of Ghana and its president, Kwame Nkrumah, were implicated in the coup and assassination of Olympia, Togo's first president, investigation was never completed. However, it left a feeling of unrest among Brits who lived and worked there, and Pauline and Richard were moving to Kenya on the east coast. I decided Africa was out for now, so what to do? I met Jeremy that evening at our usual seat in the garden. I reiterated that our conversation would be between him and me. I told him everything. "Ah," he said, his Scottish brogue comforting to my ears. "It wouldn't do me any good to get myself dismissed either, so you can rest assured your secret is safe with me." He rested his arm across my shoulders. "Look," he said, "if you don't want to go home, why not get an apartment in New York? Think of it as a positive thing. You've got your legal green card now. You can come and go across the pond just as you like." "But what would I do here?" "You're a secretary, aren't you? What about your company in England? Didn't your boss say there he'd get you a job in one of the brokers on Wall Street? Isn't that true?" I nodded, too miserable to really concentrate on what he was saying. "Well, how am I going to live while I'm trying to get employment here or wait for my boss in UK to fix me up? $500 is not going to last long, is it?" "Here's what I'm thinking," he said, taking my hand in his. "Here's a plan. I have a good friend in Manhattan. His name is Ronald Duluth. He's a photographer for a big magazine. I reckon if I told him about you and how pretty you are, he might want to photograph you. And pay, he'd pay. Yep, he'd pay you quite a sum." "Why would he pay me?" "He takes photographs for Playboy magazine." "What?" For the first time that day, I laughed. "Jeremy, I couldn't do that."
"Why not?"
"You mean nude. It's big money. Very big money, just for showing what you've got, that's all I'm saying." "Oh, don't be so daft. I don't have the face or the figure." He turned to me to take my face in his hands. "Look, if I liked women that way," Jeremy emphasized the words "that way," "I'd have made a play for you myself. You've got a pretty face. A lovely petite figure, don't estimate that. I bet you'd look great in the nude. You won't be a problem." I felt the heat rise to my face. "Oh, I don't think so. Anyway, I couldn't do it. I mean, I pose without a stitch on." "I bet you would, if he offered you $2,000.
$2,000? and you wouldn't have to worry about him trying to get you in the sack. He's like me.
You mean,
Yeah, we were partners at one time. Not new. He found someone else.
I had no idea about you.
I hope not. I wouldn't have wanted it to be obvious.
Is that why you weren't drafted into the military?
No. I have asthma. I think I was born with it. I'm much better here. But in Scotland, I was a mess. I think I'm actually growing out of it. Anyway, back to you. I can ask Ron to find you an apartment. He knows Manhattan well. And if you decide to go for a photograph and he likes what he sees, you should really think seriously about it. The money'll help until you get a proper job.
A proper job. Now that was something to consider. So we had a plan, and I didn't tell Robin I was not going home. She gave Jeremy permission to take the day off, to drive me to the airport and pick something up she'd ordered from Saks. On the morning of my departure, Clifford Devereux said how sorry he was to hear about my mother. I glanced at Robin and she was nodding. She said,
I hope she'll get better soon.
Deceitful lady, I thought. She was still talking.
Canyon will be sorry to hear you had to leave us in such a hurry.
Canyon was away on an excursion on the Caribbean with some of his yachting friends. So I stashed the first class ticket safely away at the bottom of my suitcase, knowing that I could always change the date and use it for my return to UK if things didn't work out. In the meantime, Jeremy had arranged with Ron to meet at an apartment he'd found in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue. I had never seen such an odd configuration of houses. Steps led up to the front door, and steps led down to an apartment underneath that was to be mine. The hallway was dark, the living room small and narrow with very ugly brown furniture. The kitchen was just a counter, sink and an electric stove set back in an alcove off the living room, where the sliver of daylight slanted through a mesh-covered glass, a window that was close to the ceiling. There was a wire grid over the window, obviously because it was just below ground level. I was never going to be able to see anything but a wall. A tiny bedroom at the end of the hall reminded me of the spare room we called the box room at home in England. The whole apartment was very drab and dark, a place I would never choose to live. There was no sign of luxury. It was the antithesis of Fairview House. But what could I do at that time? I didn't know New York or anyone in it. I asked myself a million times what good it could do to just sit around in a strange city and wait for news of Colin. I had heard from his mother, a short note saying there was no news. No news was good news. As I had said to her, so not to give up hope that Colin would soon be rescued from whatever hell he was in. I was pleasantly surprised when I met Ronald Duluth. He had an easy smile and seemed genuinely pleased to meet me. He certainly scrutinized me from head to toe, and I assume he was looking to see if I was the right material for a nude photograph. He reminded me of Canyon with his blonde curly hair and blue eyes. His face was angular, and his skin had a pallor that indicated his delicate health. I thanked him for arranging for the apartment for me, although I knew I really would not be able to stay in that dungeon for long. It seemed inevitable that I would have to get a job if I was to survive in New York. The question hung in the air like a black cloud. If I didn't get something, I would be forced to become a nude model. The question was, really, would I be good enough to feature in a famous magazine like Playboy? If I was rejected when they saw the photos, would I end up in some sleazy magazine? My figure was not bad. Good proportions, long legs for my height of 5'3", but only 34A bra, not exactly voluptuous. $2,000 would help to rent a nice apartment, though. Already I was warming to the idea. No one would know it was me.
my name could be changed for a caption, if they had to have a name. A couple of days later, after trying to settle in what I now labelled the apartment, the dungeon, I ventured into the city from Flatbush to Manhattan. I walked up to the door with the polished brass plaque that read, R. Duluth, Photographer. New York was sweltering in July heat.
Have been listening to episode 15 of 9 o'clock Horses. Please tune in next week to episode 16. This is Angela Ewing with Curry Coast Community Radio. Thank you for listening.